The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Where is the Food Lover's Village?
The Food Lover's Village is my nickname for the fictional town of Jewel Bay, Montana, which bears a strong resemblance to Big Fork, but with a little flavor of, oh gosh, Whitefish, Kalispell, Apgar, Red Lodge, all the fun little interesting towns of Montana.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Leslie Budowitz about her food lover's mystery, Death El Dente. This book is part of a genre that I don't know too much about, foodie literature. Is that what you would call it?
I would call it a cozy mystery, but I like food lit, too.
It seems to be getting more popular, I think. I've seen more and more books that have recipes in the back, like yours does. What attracted you to this genre? Did you start out writing a mystery and it turned into a book that featured food?
I'd been writing mysteries for quite a while. Like most new writers, this is my first published book, but not my first manuscript. There are a few in boxes in the closet. And they were all mysteries. And I think that when I started writing fiction a number of years ago, it came out as mystery because I had been living in the Mission Valley, and I'd been driving down to Missoula regularly. And I was listening to a lot of books on tape, and they actually were on tape. It was that long ago. And they were mostly mysteries. They were Sarah Paretsky and Sue Grafton and Tony Hillerman and Ellis Peters and Elizabeth Peters. And I really enjoyed the mysteries. So I kept writing them. And when I wrote this one, I wanted to write in the lighthearted mystery, the lighthearted tradition, what's sometimes called a cozy, because they are a lot of fun. And I was looking to add some fun to my writing life. The food part, well, don't we all just really secretly love to eat?
I do.
For some of us, it's not that secret. And, you know, there's a tradition, a new tradition of the lighthearted mystery that focuses on food. And I think it's got a tremendous appeal to lovers of the mystery, but also, as you mentioned, to lovers of other kinds of fiction who enjoy exploring the world through more than sight, using their taste buds as well. And, you know, I think food is the heart of so many traditions, so many rituals and events in our lives that it's rich with opportunities for fiction and metaphors and symbols as well.
In addition to being a writer, you're also an attorney, aren't you?
Yes.
How did you make that transition?
Well, I'd say I'm in the process of making it right now. I have been writing since I was a little girl. Literally at age 4, I wrote on my father's desk. I did not yet understand the concept of paper. Fortunately, my parents were very forgiving about that.
Oh, you wrote on your father's desk.
On his desk, quite literally. And I've always enjoyed writing stories, but, you know, I didn't think that you could actually make a career doing that. So my practical streak sent me to law school and then nearly 30 years of practice. But about 15 years ago, I started writing seriously and am working on making a transition into writing full time.
Well, Aaron Murphy is the main character of this book and the narrator of Death El Dente. When the story begins, she's back in her hometown of Jewel Bay. She's been there for about 2 months. Where was she before, and explain why she came back?
Aaron's story is a common Montana story. The Montana kid who grows up here, in her case, she went to college here, right here at UM, and decided, like many of us, that maybe she needed to see another part of the country. And she went out to Seattle and eventually became a grocery buyer at my version of Costco. I call it Save Club. And she lived in the heart of the city and worked there for about 10 years. Now her mother has been asking her to come home back to Jewel Bay and work with her, Fresca, the mother. Fresca is a nickname for Francesca. And help her run Murphy's Mercantile.
A family business.
Which is the grocery store and gift shop that Fresca's been running in the 100-year-old building that Aaron's great-grandfather built when he started the town's first grocery.
There's a lot on the front of this book. It says, A Food Lover's Village Mystery. And it says, It Takes a Village to Catch a Killer.
I love that.
It's a very cute cover. Well, Aaron has big plans, which you write about in the first pages of the novel. And I'd like you to read just a short passage there.
Who put these huckleberry chocolates on the front counter? I grabbed the stack of purple boxes crammed with gooey huckleberry-filled chocolate wannabes swathed in purple foil and shoved them onto an open shelf on the side wall next to the herbal snooze. I did, honey, my mother said. Our customers love them. Our customers, I said. Buy one for 75 cents and walk around the store so preoccupied with unwrapping it and indulging their sweet tooth that they can't fathom buying Montana-made goat cheese or buffalo jerky or your pastas and sauces. Then they grab a napkin that costs us 5 cents apiece to wipe purple goo off their fingers and half of them drop it on the floor. There goes our profits. My mother scowled. Aaron, what on earth has gotten into you? Why do you hate huckleberry chocolates? I don't hate huckleberry chocolates. I love huckleberry chocolates. But we can't rebuild this business on fake food and chemical sugar. She picked up the boxes I'd just moved and carried them back to the cash register. We have always had huckleberry chocolates right here, where the customers can see them. Mom, you hired me to run the place, remember? To shake things up. Some things shouldn't be changed. Mom, we agreed. The Merc will die if it's just another knick-knacky gift shop. But an artisan market for local and regional foods? These are local. They're made 5 miles from here by a woman you've known half your life. With high fructose corn syrup and milk chocolate that tastes like rancid Hershey's. If we find a vendor using fresh berries, real sugar, and high-quality fair trade dark chocolate, 60% cocoa solids or better, I will build the great pyramid of huckleberry chocolates right here. I jabbed at a spot on the oak floor, 10 feet inside the Merc's front door. Little changed in the 100 years since my grandfather Murphy built the place and opened the town's first grocery. I will worship at her kitchen stove. I will put an ad in the paper and a post on Facebook offering a free huckleberry truffle to everyone who walks in that door. And if they aren't wrapped in purple paper, I will even consider raising the price split. My mother stared as though she didn't recognize me. Not for the first time since I'd returned to Jewel Bay, Montana, the hometown I couldn't wait to leave after high school 14 years ago, to take over her struggling business so she could focus on building her own product line. And not, I was sure, the last. But Aaron, chocolate isn't local. Neither is sugar. Tracy, my shop clerk and sole employee, cocked her head, her thick chestnut hair swaying. One elaborately beaded earring brushed her plump shoulder. That's not the point. I reshelved the chocolates. Poor things. Not their fault they represented the worst of the specialty food market. Overprocessed and overpriced, they were nothing more than overhyped M&Ms that melted in your hand and gummed up your mouth. Our mission is to sell high-quality, natural and organic food. Real food. Sustainably grown. We'd been over this, and my mother had agreed, knowing the Merc desperately needed a change in direction to survive. But while she'd turned over the reins, she hadn't quite given up control. We showcase the local, but we won't sacrifice quality for proximity. We are selling a vision, the natural taste of Montana. If it's made in Montana, it must be good. Tracy repeated our new slogan in a sing-song voice, her earrings swaying like a drunk, failing a field sobriety test. She squeezed her Diet Coke can. Its metallic twang made my brain hurt. I think you're taking this festa too seriously, my mother said. Like you always do, I heard in her tone. Why don't you eat something? Slice up some tomatoes and fresh mozzarella with basil and that yummy herbed olive oil. I groaned inwardly. The two women who ran Rainbow Lake Garden had brought us incredible early girl tomatoes and heavenly Genovese basil from their greenhouse. Perfect for Caprese salad, the dish the angels serve when God needs a snack. Mom, thanks. You go ahead and eat, but I've got too much to do. We still have to decorate. The Merck, formerly known as the Glacier Mercantile, backed onto a small courtyard. Our next-door neighbor, Red's Bar, sported a larger courtyard. Tonight we were throwing open the gate between the two and hosting the kickoff dinner for the first annual Jewel Bay Festa di Pasta. Tracy and I had decorated our space that morning, but old Ned Redaway, a.k.a. Red, didn't want to doll the place up until his Friday burgers and beer lunch crowd had cleared the door, which meant ignoring my gurgling tummy until every table was set and the last lights strung. Meanwhile, we had a store to spiff up. For the next hour, we filled shelves and displays with goods our vendors and producers had delivered and worked with the smattering of midday customers. I helped my mother, Francesca, a.k.a. Fresca, refill the coolers and shelves that held our signature products and biggest sellers, her handmade pastas, both fresh and dried, and a dozen varieties of sauce and pesto. That done, she restocked wine from Monteverde Vineyard, Chardonnay, a red blend, and cherry wine with the peppery vibrance of a young Pinot Noir. She cradled a bottle of prize-winning Viognier, admiring the label my sister had designed. I paused to read over my mother's shoulder. Looks great, doesn't it? Chiara turned Jennifer's scribbles into a brand with a simple, attractive message. Yes, she said. It says, drink me. I laughed and kissed her cheek. Working with four, my mother wasn't always easy, but we were still the Murphy girls. On the surface, the Merck looked like any other specialty food shop. In reality, we were more like a co-op, with nearly two dozen regional growers and producers consigning their food and drink for sale in a single space. I wanted to prove that even a small mountain town with long winters and a short growing season could do a lot to feed itself, while sharing local bounty with our thousands of summer visitors. In the 2 months since I'd been back in town, we'd redefined our goals and realigned our product mix. The Festa, a village-wide event I'd conceived to celebrate the start of summer, was the big test. After all, we called ourselves the Food Lovers Village.
You've been listening to Leslie Budowitz read from her Food Lovers mystery novel, Death al Dente. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. Leslie and I will be right back after a short break to talk about the challenges of working in a family business and about some trouble with Aaron's childhood girlfriend, Kim, the detective in charge of the murder investigation. Stay with us. So obviously there is a complicated family dynamic going on. Erin comes across as a pretty type A person, but we find out that her mother is fairly strong as well.
I think the challenge of working with a parent is one of the themes of the story. It's not something I have personal experience with, but I have certainly observed a lot of people who maybe want their children involved in the business, but giving up control is sometimes a little tricky.
Especially something you've been doing your whole life.
Yes.
Well, talk a little bit about that festival that Erin is planning.
Ah, the Festa de Pasta. I have no idea where that came from. It just seemed like town needed a festival to start things off. And I also knew that Erin was going to want to be in charge of something pretty quickly. She wants to put her stamp on the Merck, and she wanted to do something that's going to help her make her mark in town. She's been away a long time. A lot of things have changed. Some haven't. She doesn't always know which is which. And so the Festa is a way for her to create an identity as somebody who makes things happen in this little town.
And she also, in addition to getting some pushback from her mother, she also runs into a little opposition from other business owners in the town, like she's coming in and taking over.
There are some people who adore the idea of another festival. There are some who just don't quite see why we need yet another festival. This is a town that's got a lot of them. And so there's that natural tension between wanting to keep things the same and wanting to shake them up.
And there's always a natural tension when people grow up together, and then the hierarchy happens in the small town. One person gets a position of authority and another person is, you know, the waitress or whatever.
You're thinking in part of Deputy Sheriff Kim Caldwell.
Yes.
Who is very important in the story. And she and Erin grew up together, were good friends until the middle of their senior year in high school when Erin's father was killed in a hit-and-run car accident that's never been solved, although I promise you it will be solved in book three.
Ah, I was waiting for it to be solved. I have an idea of what happened. I'm not going to say it. Anyway, let's go back to this story. So it is a murder mystery, and the murder happens fairly soon in the book. And while Erin is planning her festival, she's got a to-do list, and she goes downtown and sees Claudette, who used to work for Erin's mother. Explain the circumstances of why she doesn't work there anymore, because I think it's hilarious.
Well, Claudette is one of those people who brims with energy and never can settle on anything. She's a hummingbird. In fact, she's wearing a sundress splattered with the bird of paradise flower, and I think that's the perfect image for her. She had worked in a number of local shops, and most recently she'd come to work with Fresca so that Fresca could focus on making her food products rather than on trying to run the shop. But it turns out Claudette had an urge to follow her boyfriend, the Elvis impersonator, and ran off to Las Vegas with him when he decided to pursue a PhD, a doctorate of Elvisology.
Is that a real thing?
I hope not.
That was a very strange career choice.
Especially for a chiropractor.
Chiropractor, right. Well, I'd like you to read another short passage, the one in which Erin meets Claudette downtown.
I'd been making lists and gathering supplies for weeks, but it wouldn't hurt to have more votive candles for the lanterns. On my way home to shower and change, I detoured to the grocery store on the highway to rustle up a few. After buying all their white and yellow candles, I headed to the drugstore to check their supply. If all went well, there would be more Festas to come, and candles keep. And if it went badly, a dynamo and a riotous sundress darted out of a doorway and across the sidewalk in front of me. The splashes of orange, purple, and greens against a white background looked like a bird of paradise in flight. Claudette! She slammed to a stop, long light brown curls flying, face hot pink. You're back! We just heard. She jerked a thumb at Dean Vincent's chiropractic clinic, tucked into a small space beside the drugstore. After all I did for him, what's wrong? What happened? I gave up everything to help him pursue his dream, and all along, her rage steamed the air between us, nothing but a ruse to make his wife jealous. I pulled her to a bench outside the drugstore and made her sit. He talked me into going to Las Vegas so he could study Elvisology. I thought he loved me and we were starting over together somewhere new. More sobbing. Blubbering. But he never meant any of it. I rummaged in my bag for a clean tissue and slipped it into her tiny, trembling hand. I am mortified, she said, her voice high and strained. What will people think? That Dean's a jerk. A small laugh. And that I'm a complete fool who can't do anything right. Well, I know that feeling. Her eyes widened. You? You've got to be kidding. Dare I ask? Just dive in. Claudette, I've been hearing. She stopped crying. What? What are you hearing? That you've been telling people. Aaron, that bad taste in your mouth is your foot. But you're in this far, keep going. That my mother stole your recipes and forced you out to make room for me. What? That's ridiculous. I never said anything like that. She blew her nose, turning it red. Who said that? Oh my gosh, Fresca must be furious with me. She doesn't believe it. But before I could suggest she tell my mother herself, a male voice broke in. Claudette. Dean Vincent didn't look much like Elvis today in his khakis, sky blue button-down, and L.L. Bean mocks, though he had the height and the dark, full hair. The casual Friday look in cities, everyday garb for small-town professionals. His eyes barely registered me. Claudette, be reasonable, she rose. How dare you call me unreasonable? She'd perfected the short woman's trick of looking up with only her eyes, keeping the rest of her face level and her voice sharp but steady, intimidating with presence instead of size. I never meant to hurt you. He sounded like he actually believed himself. No, just string me along and make me look like an idiot. Time for me to say goodbye. I glanced at the drugstore entrance, surprised to see Chef James Angelo, my mother's sauce-making rival, watching from the doorway. Claudette, honey. Dean took a step forward, one hand extended. Can't we talk? She stiffened. Don't you touch me. He raised both hands in defeat. Okay, okay, I just wanted to say I'm sorry. He backed away and slipped inside his clinic. Claudette sank back onto the bench. All my plans ruined. There's always plan B, I said. She sighed. Too late for that. Come to the festa tonight. We're kicking off summer with an Italian dinner at the Merck. All local ingredients, wine, music. Everyone will be thrilled to see you. A spark lit her hazel eyes. Really? You think your mother wouldn't mind? Mind? She'd be furious if I didn't invite you. The courtyard, 6-ish. That would quell the gossip.
And that's the last time Aaron sees Claudette alive. And the gossip, instead of getting quelled, just expands. And Aaron's mother, as it turns out, is blamed for the murder initially. And that brings us back to Kim, Aaron's childhood friend, who's now a detective in town, who's conducting the investigation. Fresca's a little surprised by her attitude because as a teenager, as a child, she sat at their family dinner table and she was like an extra member of the family. But now she's treating her like a criminal and won't even smile.
Fresca doesn't really want to believe that anyone would suspect her of anything. She is certain that Kim knows better because Kim, as you say, was another child at her table, just as Aaron was often at the table at the Caldwell Ranch. Fresca's a little naive that way. She thinks that because she didn't do anything, that she'll be fine. She doesn't really see a need to defend herself. And Aaron sees otherwise.
She's working her job and planning this festival and running the business and running around trying to solve this mystery.
I think the amateur sleuth is a very important and interesting figure in a traditional mystery. There's always an official investigation, and that's what Kim represents. The official investigation is obviously an important part of the realism of the story. Its role is to restore external order in the community, while the amateur sleuth ultimately solves the crime because she knows something about the community. She has an ability to roam around it, to ask questions, to find out things that the official investigator can't do. And her role as a detective is ultimately not just to solve the crime, but to restore the social order of the community. And in this kind of mystery, the lighthearted, what's often called the cozy, the social order of the community is ultimately the most important thing.
And it's kind of in tatters right after Claudette gets killed.
Yes, there are rumors swirling, people in town who've always thought Fresca Murphy was just too good to be true, too nice to be true. She can't really be all that she seems to be. She must have a secret in there somewhere. People kind of want to, there are people who kind of want to dislike her. And rumors in the small towns sometimes really swirl.
One of the things I noticed with Erin when she was going around the community trying to figure this out is that the murder weapon was a knife, and she kept seeing knives everywhere.
Yes. It's red car syndrome. Once you decide that there aren't that many red cars around and you want to buy a red car, then you see them everywhere. The same with Erin and the knives. And it turns out, and she'd never really noticed it, that every man she meets and a number of the women, too, have knives close by.
And that made her list of suspects get bigger and bigger and bigger.
It also made it harder for her to figure out who she ought to really suspect, because too many people had access to the murder weapon, or at least what she thought the murder weapon would be.
How does the idea of place influence your storytelling?
I consider myself a very placed writer. Everything I write, all my fiction, has had a really strong element of place. I would not be who I am as a person if I had not grown up in Montana. And the same is true of my characters. To me, I just don't understand a relationship between people without the place also being part of it. There are a lot of tensions in the fictional town, but it's still a really sweet, pretty wonderful place to be.
Death al Dente is advertised as the first in a new series. So what's coming up next?
The second book is called Crime Rib. It will be out in July of 2014. Erin is helping bring to town the crew of Foodpreneurs, a popular TV show. And there will be a filming of the annual Steak Grill-Off. One of three hot local chefs is killed, and Erin must smoke out the murderer before the town's reputation goes up in smoke. The third book will take place in winter during a food film festival. Big Fork doesn't actually have a food film festival, so I get to make one up completely. I think it would be a lot of fun. I'm also working on the first in the Seattle Spice Shop Mysteries, tentatively called Spiced to Death.
Leslie Budowitz lives in northwest Montana. There's more about her and her book at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. And while you're there, click over and like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.